Welcome to the My Stogie Mystagogy podcast with your hosts, Don Gonzalez
and Mark Connolly,
where we get together and discuss everything from the sublime
to the ridiculous.
So what you smoking and what you drinking?
So I am smoking a Cavalier Genève, and it says a black 2. So it's a Maduro. It's one of those cigars that has the actual gold leaf on it.
Did you acquire this at the Big Smoke?
I mean, yes, I did, but I've had one of these before. I had got them from, I can't remember the name of the cigar club. But I was all concerned because it said it's an actual gold leaf, and I was like, what happens if you smoke that? And apparently you don't really smoke it. The fire is not hot enough to do anything to that gold. So it just a little shrivels up when it gets down there. And then I'm drinking Woodford Reserve.
Anything else you want to say about the cigar? You've been smoking it for a few minutes.
Yeah. So, you know, the running joke is I don't really pick up all the nuances and all that. So my thoughts on the cigar really have to do with if it's harsh or mild. And if it's burning smooth or not. And this is actually a mild cigar. A lot of people think Maduros are stronger or whatever, but it has less to do with the wrapper color and more to do with the filler. Like a Ligero is going to be much stronger. Maduro basically just means ripe, and they can be very mild. And this one's actually a pretty mild cigar. It's burning a little uneven, but that may be because of where it was sitting in my humidor. I enjoyed these when I've had them before. Like I said, they're mild. And I'm smoking it with Woodford Reserve.
So I don't generally smoke Maduros unless it's like the Añejo. Do you find that the Maduros tend to be sweeter tasting than like a natural wrapper? Or is that a misnomer as well?
I don't think it's sweeter. It has a different profile. But I just think of it as ripe. And if you want to think of a banana being ripe as sweeter, I guess that would apply. But as noted, I don't really pick up a lot of flavor.
Fair enough. All right. Well, no surprise. I'm smoking an Arturo Fuente. And tonight, I'm smoking a work of art from the Hemingway series. I'd say the work of art is kind of the middle of the road. I can't remember what the ring gauge on it. It is a perfecto shaped. It means it tapers and gets larger towards the foot of the cigar. It has a Cameroon wrapper with Dominican binder and filler from the Chateau Fuente in the Dominican Republic. I like this cigar, and my favorite of the line is the smallest of them, which is the short story. Mm-hmm. But because when we get together, we tend to talk for longer, I want to have a cigar that's going to last a little bit longer. So this is my hour and a half smoke. But I like the Cameroon wrapper because it does leave a sweet taste in your mouth at the end of the smoking of it. And the Dominican filler, you'll pick up a little bit of spiciness with it. I find that the flavor profile is slightly different for the larger cigar than it is for the smaller cigar. But depending on, like, with the, I'm also having the Woodford Reserve. I will pick up hints of, like, spiciness, especially when it's paired with bourbon like this. In the old days, when you and I first started getting together, I would drink pirate rum.
Right.
And that would draw out almost an apricot sort of flavor from the cigar. But I think that's an interesting thing about pairing cigars with different drinks. Like, depending on what the drink is, may affect the flavors that you're pulling out. And I think that's also true with what you eat. Like, I know Stacy and I had a ritual back in the day when Sopranos was a big thing on TV. We would have a steak dinner in preparation for watching the show. And then she and I would actually smoke a cigar afterwards. And I tended to pair that with a Rocky Patel 1992. And that the steak would pull out all those peppery flavors from that cigar.
You know, you mentioned that yours is a tapered on the end. This one is as well. This cigar, if you're familiar with the Monte Cristo number 2, it's about the same size and shape, except it seems to be a mild box press. So it's not, it doesn't have the crisp edges, but it's definitely got a flat to it.
I see that.
So that would make it around 6 inches, and this is maybe a 48 ring gauge, my guess.
All right, well, that's what we're smoking and drinking, and if we pick up anything different, we'll share that later on.
And if you do smoke something while you're listening to this podcast, we'd like to know what it is. So feel free to make a comment in the comment section.
Good point.
So tomorrow is Christ the King.
Of the universe.
Of the universe. Which before we started this podcast, we were talking about, so what do you do if you run into the aliens out there?
Well, I think the analogy of evangelizing to parts of the planet Earth where people had not been exposed to the gospel would probably still apply.
Yeah. I do think we struggle a little bit with the fact that all of our aliens, except for the movie Alien, basically look like exaggerated versions of ourselves. But you had made the point, well, Jesus came as a human. And so it made me wonder if there is life on other planets, did he show up at these other planets in whatever format? C.S. Lewis actually did a series of books. It's a trilogy, a science fiction trilogy. It's called Perlandria. And in that book, he said that Mars had had the basically their Adam and Eve, but they had not fallen. So they didn't have Jesus.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that C.S. Lewis had written science fiction.
Yep. I forget the name of all three books, but one of them is called That Hideous Strength. I think that's the final book. I think the first book may just be called Perlandria. And I can't remember the second one. But Nathan and Tiffany named one of their kids after the main character in there, whose name was Ransom. And that's an intentional call out to being ransomed for our sins.
Am I remembering correctly that C.S. Lewis was way more intentional about the symbolism that he used in his writing as compared to Tolkien, who was more subtle in his...
Yeah, I think the Chronicles of Narnia, the character of Aslan is clearly Jesus. I mean, he's killed, and then 3 days later he rises. They don't really have that kind of thing in Tolkien. Tolkien is much, much more subtle. So I'm going to say yes, but I've only read 2 of the Chronicles of Narnia. So I don't have the full exposure to all the potential symbolism that's in there.
I only want to stay on this for a while, otherwise we'll get sidetracked. And I don't know that I've got the bandwidth to discuss the salvation of aliens tonight. Yeah. Only as an analogy, and you are the king of analogies, so I'm going to go out on a limb here and see if this works. You've been to the Basilica in Washington, D.C., right?
Yes.
And if you've ever been, you know, just for the listeners that may have never been there before, one of the really cool things is, so it's the Basilica to the Immaculate Conception.
Right.
So it's a Marian Basilica. And all along the sides are these small chapels that are dedicated to various apparitions of Our Lady in different countries. And every time she appears to a different country, she looks like those people.
Yeah.
So by analogy, I would think that if Christ needed to be somewhere for another group of humanoids or whatever.
Right. Slime creatures.
He would, or Sleestak.
Yes.
He would appear that way. I don't know. That's just my take on that. I've never, going to be honest with you, I've never seen anything seriously written about that.
Yeah, I haven't either. I don't think it's on the list of probable events that need to be addressed.
I don't know. From a pastoral sort of standpoint of meeting people where they are, you might encounter that sort of question from somebody that's into science fiction or somebody that believes in that sort of thing. So
I do remember, I think it was Professor Herman that asked the question, what do you do with a pig that knows it's a pig and knows that it knows it's a pig? You baptize it because that would make it a rational creature. And since the rational soul is the form of the human being, then if the pig knew he was a pig and knew that he knew, in other words, had that self-reflective understanding, then that would indicate it was rational and so had a rational soul and needed to be baptized, assuming it was suffering from original sin. Which, when you think of Christ as king of the universe, I've also heard that the whole universe kind of went out of balance with the Adam and Eve sin. That would imply, at some level, that concept of original sin having universal repercussions.
Is Mary's title also Queen of the Universe? No, she's Queen of the Heavens.
Which you would think is the universe, but I don't know.
Right, so,
Enough alien talk.
yes. So Christ the King, King has a throne. What's Christ's throne?
Crucifix.
And why is that, Mark?
Well, he was crowned. That's where the battle was won. That's where he ascended his throne and saved his subjects, if you will. Seems like an odd thing to call a throne, but I think it is his throne.
Well, that's where he truly becomes the king of glory, right? I think at Joe Catholic, Lyndon gave a talk on Christ the King where he talked about the cross. There are a lot of depictions and art of Jesus on the cross, not as a suffering, but dressed in like kingly garb with the golden crown and all of that to depict the symbolism.
Yeah. So why do you suppose that ends the liturgical year?
That's a good question. Well, I think I talked about this. I don't know if it was on air or not, but starting in like mid-October, we started to have all these gospel readings that were about end times or the final things. And if I remember correctly, at least in one of the cycles, the gospel reading has something to do with that as well.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, I didn't take a look to see what the gospel reading is going to be tomorrow. That might be something you can do on your phone since, but that the culmination of all of our deaths is going to be an encounter before the King.
Yeah.
Going back to saying that the cross is his throne, it's his victory over death and his victory over sin. So at the end of our time or the big time, there will be that close encounter with Christ the King. What do you think about that?
I think that's accurate. Advent as the beginning of the liturgical year is the season leading up to Christ entering his creation, God entering into his creation as one of his creations, if you think about it. He arrives as a baby and leaves as a grown man. But I think that is the second coming. The whole the as you mentioned, these gospel readings are leading up to the final act when Christ the second coming, and when everybody will know. They talk about every knee will bend. I think it was Deacon Walt that said something about, do you want to fall to your knees naturally, or do you want to be forced to your knees by an angel? I never liked that. I think that at the second coming, people will know, and they'll fall to their knees, because what else can you do in the face of God?
Well, or they won't.
Yeah.
Because people were there for all the miracles and yet they still didn't believe.
That's true. That's confusing to me, but it's true. I say that's confusing to me. That might be some hubris. Who knows if I would have, what I would have done in that circumstance. I'd like to think that I would recognize.
Well, I mean, if we're properly disposed and we have, a sacramental life and we have a prayer life, then we, you would think you'd be able to recognize when he comes.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, though, because how many people today would go, well, I saw Chris Angel do that. If Jesus came down right now and did a miracle, would anybody believe it? Would they just think it's, a magician, David Copperfield? I hear he's going to make the moon disappear. I wonder, were people more open to mystery back then than they are today? So the gospel reading for tomorrow is Matthew 25, 31 through 46. And that is, it's long. Well, I guess not that long. So Jesus said to his disciples, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit upon his glorious throne, and all the nations will be assembled before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will place the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. A stranger, and you welcomed me. Naked, and you clothed me. Ill, and you cared for me. In prison, and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him and say, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you ill or in prison and visit you? I'm going to pause there and go, that's an interesting call out because, we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so this would indicate the righteous were just loving their neighbors, not necessarily thinking about how they were being, doing all these things that Jesus said he did, that you fed me. Oh, it just hit me as I was reading it. They're asking, when did I see you? They knew they had done all these things, but they didn't connect the dot there. When did blah, blah, blah? And the king will say to them in reply, Amen, I say to you, whatever you did for one of the least brothers of mine, you did for me. Then he will say to those on his left, Depart from me, you accursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devils and his angels. I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. A stranger and you gave me no welcome. Naked and you gave me no clothing. Ill and in prison and you did not care for me. Then they will answer and say, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or ill in prison and not minister to your needs? He will answer them, Amen, I say to you, what you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. And these will go off to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. Pretty unambiguous.
So it is about the final judgment.
Yep.
And what I take from that as I hear it is that, when you're baptized into his family and we become his adopted, God's adopted children. Have we talked about that phrase before?
I feel like we have, but for those of who have not listened to our podcast in the past.
Yeah, well, so it's significant in Jewish law that a father in particular could disown his biological children and the tie would be severed. But to adopt someone was contractual and you
Yeah.
couldn't break that contract. So in a strange sort of way, juxtaposed to the way we do things now, adoption is almost like a stronger bond
Yeah.
because it can't be broken. But that once we become part of his family, we're baptized and we're living a relationship with him, then we should be compelled. Like, if you're living it, then naturally it should be that you're living your life that way, that when you see people in need,
Right.
and that you're, because I don't think people, and we all know good people like this that do this. They help out of the goodness of their heart, being motivated to, you know, the Holy Spirit, etc. But I don't think people go out and say, well, I'm going to go feed the hunger or feed the hungry because I'm feeding Jesus.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was getting
right.
at.
Right, they were living out their Christian life.
Right.
And I think this goes to the notion, too, is that the call of Christianity is not one that's meant to be lived in a prayer closet.
No.
It's meant to be sent out.
Yep.
And I think that's a lot of what's being said there is like, and this goes back, you know, a couple of days ago, and I think we talked about this the other day. The gospel reading was about the 10 pounds, which is Luke's version of the story of the talents.
Right.
That you've been given these talents, so you have a responsibility to put them to use for the glory of God and for his kingdom here on earth through his people, to his people.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that I'd said before we went on air is I said, you know, if Christ is the king of the universe, then he is our king.
Yep.
And how are we letting him be king in our lives? You know, is he king of every aspect of our life or just like that Sunday part?
Yeah. Because, and that's the question, isn't it? I mean, that's truly, you know, if you're trying to figure out, you know, if somebody's curious and trying to decide, okay, am I doing what I'm supposed to do? Am I being the kind of person that I'm supposed to be? Am I living out my Christian obligation and responsibility? Well, I mean, you can look at that gospel reading right there and ask yourself, which one would you be if God came right now? Where are you?
Yeah, I mean, you could, in theory, you could be the person that goes to Mass on Sunday, Holy Days of Obligation, goes to Reconciliation once a month.
Yeah.
But there's no charity in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not doing... Faith requires action.
Yeah.
Is what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And I think that's where our Protestant brothers and sisters misunderstand that we're not earning our way into heaven. We're living the life that we're meant to be living.
Yeah. You're not saved by works, per se. But if there are no works, your faith is dead. That's what James says.
Well, your faith isn't bearing fruit.
No.
And we're called to bear fruit.
Yeah.
And so that's why God entrusts each of us with different gifts.
Yeah.
Because I don't think, you know, and feel free to disagree with me. You know, Matthew gives this litany of things that Jesus said that people did for him or did not do for him. But I don't, you know, I don't necessarily think that we're all called to do all those things all the time. You know, I know people that do prison ministry. I don't feel called to doing prison ministry. Right. I don't think I'm going to get dinged for that. But I know where I'm called to be and where I am, that I'm definitely should be living out my faith there. And I talked about this before, like with that recent death of the teacher that I didn't feel like I was witnessing to her at all.
Right. Yeah.
That's where I failed. And so instead of curling up in a ball and, you know, getting depressed about that, then I've got to use that to motivate me to be there for other people that I encounter.
Yeah.
And I do think that there's some of us that just like, I'm doing my duty. I'm going to Mass. I'm saying my prayers. That's enough.
Well, we can't be everything to everybody, but we're going to run into people in our daily life. You know, I haven't run into anybody in my family that's ended up in prison, but if they did and I didn't visit them or send them letters or do something, then I think I would definitely be failing. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that, as you said, there are people who are called to go out and do that, but there are people that go work in soup lines and, you know, kitchens for the homeless. But you're going to run into people like that at different times in your life. And the question is, without you having made a conscious decision to make this some sort of life mission, are you going to respond the way you should respond to these one-off events? And I think that matters. I think that in our day-to-day world, we need to be on the lookout for those times when did we feed them? Did we clothe them? Did we take in the wayfarer?
Did we console?
Yeah.
You know, like in my setting, I come in contact with a lot of kids that don't eat.
Mm.
And like, don't even get me started on these lunch programs that they have in schools because the food is awful. But I find myself a lot of times, especially if I order food, I order a little extra fun because I have two kids in particular I know that don't eat.
Mm.
And I've got one that I'll text. I was like, hey, there's some extra tacos in the office. Go grab a couple. Or I'll pretend like I didn't, that I was full. It's like, hey, will you do me a favor and finish this off for me?
Yeah.
And I think that's feeding the hungry.
Well, it is. Yeah.
And, you know, in my world of education, my mentor teacher years ago said something that offended one of my coworkers, but I took it to heart. She said, you know, years after a student has had you as a teacher, they're going to remember very little of the content of what you taught them. They're going to remember how you treated them.
Yep.
And this woman is self-identifies as an atheist, but those words came from her, and I've taken them to heart. And this is on my mind because I recently had a birthday, and the kids gave me a birthday card where they all wrote nice old things to me. And that's what they were talking about all the times that maybe I listened to them when they needed to be listened to.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's all people need. And there is some truth, you know, I know that in the world we live in now, people want to be seen and heard. But there's truth in that. People want to be seen and heard. And the thing that strikes me is that we as Christians, if we're not any different than everybody else, then why would anybody want what we have?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that starts off with being joyful. Because, man, it hit me really hard years ago. I was on a trip with a bunch of kids, and we were on a layover in Chicago at O'Hare. And they were all huddled around this one girl that had a camera. And I'm like, what are y'all looking at? And they had a picture of me laughing or smiling. I can't remember what. And you would have thought they had a picture of Bigfoot. Because they weren't used to seeing me smile. And that resonated with me.
Oh, wow.
So now I'm very intentional about when I greet students in the hallways, I smile and how are you doing? And really have tried to change like my exterior disposition. It wasn't that I was mad. It was just that I was so determined to get from point A to point B. I didn't realize that I had this like this mean look on my face all the time.
I should have put a blurry photo of that on a t-shirt and said, I believe.
But imagine that.
Yeah.
That it was that big of a deal. You know, sometimes people just need to hear their name.
Interesting. Like, look, here's Mr. G laughing. What? No way.
If we like open ourselves to seeing these opportunities, they'll happen all around you. I was at Sprouts the other day, and I think it was actually Thanksgiving morning because I had to go pick up mashed potatoes. You know how at this time of year it starts to get crazy at the stores.
Yep.
And there was a lady in front of me having a meltdown. She was yelling at the clerk.
Hmm.
The clerk was being really patient. The woman was trying to exchange, I don't know if it was a drink or salad dressing or whatever. She didn't have a receipt, but she was trying to show how the transaction had taken place on her phone. And the young lady behind the counter wasn't arguing with her. She's trying to accommodate her. And she figured out how much it was, and she gave the woman back $7. And then as she handed her the dollar, she actually held both of her hands in a gesture of kindness to say, "I hope your day gets better." And the woman then grabs the bottle and leaves. So the very thing that she had just gotten a refund for, she took with her.
Wow.
And the girl behind the counter was just like, "Did you just see that?" And she got really upset. And I was still standing in line when she called the manager over, and she was upset. And the manager was like, "Well, why didn't you call me?" And she's like, "Well, I just did. It happened so fast." He was like, "Well, how much was it?" And she said, $7. And he's like, "Don't worry about it." And she was upset. And I just turned to her in that moment. And I said her name. And I was like, I think her name was Brenda. But Brenda, don't let this mess up the rest of your day. And then it was like she let it go in that moment.
Yeah.
And I guess it crushed her because she did everything right.
Yeah.
And then she gave an act of kindness by holding her hand. And then I've got to be honest with you. I don't think the woman did it on purpose. I think we sometimes get in these modes where you give money, you get chained, and you grab your thing.
She had a moment of confusion because the reaction she got from that lady confused her, I think.
The kindness.
Yes. And she didn't know what to do about it. And all she could do is flee the situation. And
Yeah.
yeah, I was wondering that what you just said. You don't think she actually consciously stole the item?
Yeah, I don't think she did. But that's a small thing.
Yeah.
But I think if we're sensitive to those sorts of things, then we can be exactly what Christ is asking us to
Yeah.
do. I think too many times, I think we get caught up in this, like, I'm going to do these big things, but we're not willing to do the little things.
Yep.
And I really think it's in those moments that we're really being tested.
Yeah, 'cause I can see how you can you could ignore somebody right in front of you because you're busy slaying a dragon or whatever, doing something that you think is big.
Well, I know from my standpoint, if I'm being just brutally honest, if this would have happened 15 years ago, I would have been irritated. I would have been impatient at the woman behind me.
Yeah.
And I would have been caught up in just, why is this taking so long?
Yeah.
Because I was, what Stacy and I did for Thanksgiving is we pre-ordered meals from Cracker Barrel, and I had an 11:30 appointment. I knew that I'd timed it, so I was going to get there in line just in time to pick it up. And now I'm stuck behind all of this.
Yeah.
But I remember because I was, I told you I've been going back and listening to some of the original podcasts that we did a few years back, and I was listening to one, and we were talking about self-awareness. And I think this is we did an episode where we talked about habits, virtues, and vices, and being aware of what are like our primary vices. And I was sharing that I didn't know what my big rock was until I had a conversation with my then spiritual director, Father Jack, and it turned out that it was pride, but I didn't recognize pride in some of the ways that it was manifested. And one of those was like impatience. Like, my time is more valuable than yours. And so
Right.
that manifests impatience. And so, anyway, it just like, that's been a blessing because I really used to suffer from that a lot. And it still tries to rise up, and I have to fight it. But the other thing, because this is the other thing that came from that talk, was that idea that you can combat vices with virtues. And, well, pride is a form, of arrogance and self-centeredness. So I started to become intentional about humility.
Right.
And so what I started doing is, like, when we have meals with other teachers or friends, I used to be the guy who was like, I'm not gonna pick up after other people, that's their job. No, I'm intentional about, hey, are you done? Can I take that for you?
Yeah.
And but I do that not to, hey, look at me, I'm being a nice guy. It's because I have to do that.
Right.
Because that's a way for me to combat this, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I forget exactly who said this, but there's a saying that we are what we continually do. Which means you can do things until that's who you are. Just made me think that you saw the movie Unforgiven.
Yes.
And Clint Eastwood is asking Morgan Freeman to go with him on this thing. And Morgan Freeman goes, we're not bad men anymore. Because they had gotten married and had farms and kids and stuff. They had stopped. They weren't bad men anymore.
But if I remember correctly, they weren't bad men at the end. They were being protectors, weren't they?
Yeah, they had responded to, you know, somebody basically
terrorizing
the prostitutes. So they were going to care for, you know, helpless people that were being abused by the sheriff of the town who thought he was a good man. It was a brilliant movie, really.
Did that win an Academy Award?
I believe it did. We're not bad men anymore. So, Advent. The penitential season.
the annual debate.
Yeah.
Is Advent a penitential season?
I will concede that in the idea of it being a season of preparation, that I could see a penitential piece to that. It's also a season of hope.
But can't you say that about Lent, too? The hope is the resurrection, right? Everything's leading to that. I would really like to know where and when, because there are parallels.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the vestments are purple, but then you have that one week in both Advent and Lent where a rose is worn.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them have different names. For one of them's Gaudete. I can't remember what the other one is.
But Laudette.
They both mean basically joy.
Yeah.
I just think that the other parallel for me is that I think in Advent and in Lent, there should be a reinforcement and a buckling down of what I call the three legs to the stool of our spiritual lives. And that's the prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. And fasting meaning like mortification.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a reason. I mean, obviously the majority, we seemed like this year ordinary time was longer. Could be wrong. Maybe it's just normal. I don't know.
I think we went all 33 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think in some cases there's a 34th week. We have there's a brilliance in the way it's done because it's broken up to kind of refocus you.
Yeah. There is. It goes, the liturgy of the hours goes to 34 weeks of ordinary time.
See, Mark had to fact check me because he didn't think I could remember that on my own.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Because, I mean, it's as short as 31 weeks, I believe.
Yeah, you could be right. So are you going to be doing any sort of extra reflections for the Advent period?
I think I mentioned that we're doing an Advent retreat and we're focusing on hope. So we're reading Spes Alvi by then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger.
I thought he wrote that as Benedict XVI.
You fact check me then.
Well, I don't know if me messing with my phone is going to mess with the recording.
Alrighty.
But it was Pope Benedict that started the three writings on the writings on the faith, hope, and charity, because Pope Francis wanted it writing the third.
Yeah.
The first one was charity because we wrote our paper on that to get into Ave Maria.
Actually, I had to do a different one. I had to do God, why don't I remember that?
Well, I'm going to double down and say.
Well, you're right. It is Benedict the 16th. What am I thinking of? That was something else we were reading. It must have been something I read as I was preparing for the presentation on Gaudium et Spes. Encyclical letter Spes Albi of the Supreme Pontiff Benedict the 16th to the bishops, priests, and deacons, men and women religious, and all the lay faithful on Christian hope. In hope we were saved. You're right. I fact checked myself.
I don't think I've ever read that one.
It's good. Of course, I think anything he wrote was good.
Well, we wound up reading quite a bit of his stuff for IPT.
Yeah, we did.
The one on the liturgy stands out.
I'm trying to remember what it was that I wrote. I had to write a paper as part of my application process.
Well, your application was unique.
Yeah. Two interviews and a paper.
Do you want to share why?
And then a provisional semester. Yeah, it's because I don't have a bachelor's degree. So I have an associate's degree in arts and sciences and
a master's in theological studies.
Yep.
So you're a unicorn.
I guess so. And I remember being very concerned about it because it was like, well, what kind of university gives somebody a master's if they don't have a bachelor's?
That was, oh, who was it? That comedian, the cigar guy, had a brother. I don't want to belong to a club that would ever have me.
Oh, it was Groucho Marx.
Yes, yes.
I would not belong to a society that would have me as a member or a club. Yeah. So, but Professor Herman said, you know, it's not common, but it has happened that people skip a bachelor's on their way to their master's, just like they skip their associates on their way to a bachelor's degree, and people skip master's on their way to a doctorate.
Well, that's more common now that people don't even get a master's for their doctorate anymore.
Yeah. But yeah, so I had to write a paper, submit it. I had to have two live interviews. And then my first semester, I had to, can't remember if I needed at least a C+ or a B- to be considered a regular student. So my first semester was provisional.
Were you sweating bullets after that first Quizlet? Quizlet.
Quizlet, yeah. Kind of like a bomblet.
That was a Twelman test. I remember that first one was about the maps.
Yeah.
And I didn't take it very seriously because I thought, that's what I get for not reading the syllabus.
Yeah.
It's a Quizlet. And yeah, what's it worth? 10%.
Yeah, and the thing about this program was there wasn't any kind of like makeup tests or. Yeah. I had two A papers turned into C papers because they were late.
Pretty much every paper I wrote for Twelman was that.
Yeah.
Because I remember him telling me, you know, if you could get a paper in on time, you'd make an A in this course. You know, working on a graduate degree, especially one that was intense as that, and working full time is really difficult.
Yeah.
Because I remember even when I worked on my master's in education, which was not a difficult degree at all, it still put a strain on my ability to do my job. Like, my job at work suffered. Like, I was not as effective a teacher as I was beforehand. Because I was stealing time away from prepping for class to write papers or to post responses because some of it was online.
Do the substantial reading that we had to do. I did pull two all-nighters. I mean, literally stayed up all night long and went to work and then went to, no, went not to work, went like a Friday night finishing up a paper at, you know, 6:30 in the morning and taking a shower and driving off to school.
I don't think I remember doing anything like that. I think very early on, I was content with being the C student.
C's get degrees.
No, I had to just free myself from that, you know, because, and I'm not judging anybody that had this view, if you were this person, but I really tried to approach that. For me, it wound up being 3 years instead of two, or two and a half. Was I really want to learn the content, and I don't want to worry about trying to be the best student. You know, I think it became obvious to me early on that I wasn't going to be that student anyway.
Especially with the ringer in the class, guy with a doctorate in philosophy.
But I mean, I think that was also kind of a spiritual test of that goes back to the pride thing. It's like, are you doing this for the right reason? Are you trying to get, you know, recognition for doing well in the class? Or are you trying to learn more and be better prepared to? At the time, I thought I was doing it so that I could better serve Joe Catholic.
Yeah. Little did you know, it was just going to make you a better person.
Well, yeah, it's like we told people, it's like going to a retreat every month.
Yeah.
Man, when we were in it, I just know that I got so much better in terms of like the teaching I was doing at Joe Catholic and RCIA was just taken to a whole new level.
Yep.
And I've been thinking about that lately since I'm going to start in February, going to start helping with RCIA at St. Anne's. Is my old man brain going to be able to, am I going to be able to tap back into all of that having been away from it for a while?
I think you will, but I will say I think that's part of why I'm tired right now is because I've been writing a lot and thinking, and that takes, you know, that takes energy. You've heard, I'm sure, that these grandmasters, when they're playing chess, they lose weight. They'll lose a pound or two in a match. They're burning energy. And this is the most, what's the word?
He's pointing to his brain.
Yeah, the most voracious organ in your body when you're really working it. It burns a lot of calories. But oddly, I also feel more alive.
I hear you. I have felt energized and working on the podcast and adding the blog post to Joe Catholic and knowing that Joe Catholic's about to come back.
So I think you mentioned you've had this experience where you read something that you wrote a few years ago and you're like going, wow.
Yes.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Like, who wrote this? I know it was me, but.
Yeah. I've been experiencing that lately, too, going back and reading some of the old blog posts.
Yeah.
Listening to some of our old podcasts. I'm like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, am I capable of still being that person?
Yeah, I think you are.
I think these discussions will be good for that, too, because I feel like I'm exercising that muscle that.
Yeah.
And that's not to suggest that, you know, I've been continuing to do spiritual reading and all of that. And my prayer life has been pretty good. But I think there's a difference between that and sharing it with other people. And I've gotten a little taste of that because I threw my hat in the ring to be a facilitator for this small group at the Encounter School of Ministry. And the feedback that I'm getting from the people in the group makes me feel like I'm falling back into the swing of things.
Well, I think just like physical exercise, you know, our bodies were made to move and be used. And so were our brains. When you study, because, you know, you study when you're preparing these blog posts and, you know, there's study involved. You're spending some time checking yourself and looking and reading. Maybe spending some time going down a rabbit hole, not knowing what nugget you may find there, but usually coming out with something, I'm sure. It's worthwhile effort, and it's kind of its own reward. And when you're, you know, the thing that makes us a human being is our ability to reason. And when you exercise that, which makes us uniquely human, you feel more alive. At least that's my take on it. As a real quick aside, as I've been working on this series, I'm revisiting book report that I did on white fragility, specifically to explore critical theory and critical race theory in the Michel or however you pronounce the name, Foucault.
Michel.
His theory of power, basically, working towards trying to understand why so many people immediately got into victim shaming of Israel and sided with Hamas and the poor Palestinian people. I was reading a little bit more about his theories, and have you ever heard the term panopticon?
No.
So he wrote an article on discipline and punishment, I think is what it's called.
Okay.
And he had this idea of a prison where basically whoever's running the prison can see all the prisoners all the time. So they're always being watched. So it's kind of this idea of Big Brother is watching, but they're always being observed. And then if they step out of line, there's punishment. And it occurred to me that our social media platforms have become panopticons with self-appointed wardens keeping an eye on if you've got right to think or not.
Well, it's funny to me that the people that do that are not very tolerant.
They're not at all.
Yet they preach tolerance. No, that's a whole nother conversation about this world that we live in with the tribalism and labeling people and pigeonholing people based on, like, if you identify as a Christian, then you're automatically considered a hate monger for certain things.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I encountered that in the world of public education, you know. Probably one or two teachers that is right of center who speaks openly about my faith, where I have a bunch of atheists that I work with.
Right.
And, you know, for people that don't, well, it's really interesting to me how the student body has changed. Like, they're more militant and challenging you on stuff like that, that I didn't experience that early in my career. Now I do. And my response is always, you can assume anything you want to about me because you want to put a label on me because I'm Catholic or because you think I'm Republican or whatever, but judge me by the body of my work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when have you ever seen me mistreat somebody?
Yeah.
You know, because I'm pretty open. I don't care about isms.
Yeah.
You know, and whenever I get attacked that way, like, you just giving me an opening, and I'll say to the kids, it's like, you know, I'm pretty open about being Catholic. And I said, I respect you not because of some ism that you identify with, but because you're a child of God and you're made in the image and likeness. And you have dignity, period.
Yeah.
And that, there's no response to that.
No, there's not. What do you say to that? Nuh-uh. That's the level of debate. Nuh-uh. So I figured out. Not figured out. I'm a white, het, cis male Catholic, the epitome of all that's wrong in the world. Fear me.
I don't know. I think you'd have to be Protestant to be that.
Maybe.
To be a Protestant evangelical. I don't know. I don't know how we got off on that topic.
Panopticon.
So we're getting close to an hour here. What's right. The cigar telling you?
My cigar is telling me that it's almost done. It's starting to get hot at the end here.
Yeah.
So it's not mine. Quite at the little gold or diamond that's on here. Or square.
So you said it'll shrivel up once you start smoking it that?
Yeah, it just kind of turns white and shriveled, but it doesn't ash.
So did you look into how they do that?
No.
Like,
It's just gold leaf.
right, but how do they put it onto the leaf?
I think, I don't know the answer to that, so I'm going to make something up. I think gold, when it's super thin, just naturally has a quality that makes it adhere because of the nature of the metal.
You don't think they put like whatever that little gum thing is that they
They
put?
may, but I think it's more like alien tape. Heard of that?
No.
They have different names for it. Alien tape's a brand, but it's basically based on the same principle as a gecko's foot and how they can crawl up glass and stuff like that. And it's I think they call it molecular adhesion. But there's just it just sticks. And
Like Spider-Man.
gold leaf will do that.
You think or you know?
I think. Because when they gold leaf paintings and stuff like that, I don't think they glue it on. I think they just lay it on there.
Okay.
But maybe somebody can fact check us.
We can fact check ourselves.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we meandered around a little bit, but I hope you got some sort of insight from what we talked about tonight. And as we used to sign off, I remembered how we used to sign off.
Yeah.
Smoke 'em if you got 'em.
All right. So when you're all done, you would say over and out,
No,
right? No?
you would just say out.
Oh, okay.